Thanks very much, everyone, to joining us, and thank you for your time, as we're very aware that we're competing with some outstanding presenters. So thanks very much for joining us. For our session is Infrastructure, the Ultimate Inflation-Proof Asset Class. Dennis Eager is going to come up here and do the bulk of the presentation. Dennis has about 24 years infrastructure industry experience, which is pretty scary in itself. He started when he was three, so that's why he looks so young. Dennis, as part of his background, he worked at Leighton Holdings for a number of years, so he's actually on the other side of what you've seen in a lot of infrastructure deals. So he dealt with the construction side. He then moved over and was one of the first four employees at a little business you may have heard of called Macquarie Infrastructure Group. So he helped establish that and spent a number of years there. He then moved across to a business called Capital Partners, which was an institutional research house that then morphed into becoming an infrastructure investment manager. He was head of infrastructure there. And him, along with three of his employees, joined Magellan Financial Group in January of last year, and we started a fund in July of last year. I wanted to talk briefly before I bring Dennis up here about what you're looking for in inflation. And I must say that I'm just about convinced that Pippa Malgram has seen our presentation already and plagiarised all of our ideas for her plenary this morning, because we here have essentially echoed exactly what Dr. Malgram suggested so well and so eloquently earlier this morning about where you want to look for, what you want to look for in investments when you're looking for inflationary protection. And really what you see in front of you is just about verbatim what Pippa was saying this morning, and that is, firstly, you need to look for companies that exhibit a very robust revenue profile, that is those that have a very low threat of competition, that have very low elasticity of demand for the products and services that they produce. The low elasticity of demand that features for these companies obviously allows them to pass through any price increases which may occur in times of inflation. Of course, linking your revenue to inflation is absolutely the holy grail. If you have a revenue stream that's determined, like we have in the Eastern Distributor here in Sydney, that's completely linked to CPI, that's exactly where you want to be in an inflationary environment. Together with this, though, you need to have contained expense growth. And fixed costs are very preferable to variable costs, obviously. So if you have a high level of fixed costs relative to your overall cost structure, then that's a very attractive place to be, rather than having a business that runs very high variable costs as part of its overall cost structure. And this gives you low sensitivity to wage claims, so that's very, very important in an inflationary environment. And of course, increased earnings over time, as that EBITDA margin generates superior earnings over time. And finally, and this is sort of a bit counterintuitive for what we're reading a lot in the press, and I'll take you back to first year economics, be it at high school or university, debt's actually really, really good when inflation's around, because if you owe someone a dollar and there's a heap of inflation around, the value of that dollar decreases over time. The important caveat on that, of course, is that your debt is sufficiently hedged, because you don't want to be subject to interest rate increases. And Dennis will talk a bit about what infrastructure companies have their debt hedged and some that don't. So I'm going to hand over to Dennis now. Thanks very much for your time. And Dennis will talk very much about the fundamentals of the infrastructure sector and how it reacts to these important fundamentals.
Thanks, Matt. Good morning, good afternoon, as it is now to everyone. Just starting off firstly by looking at what is infrastructure, what are the different components of infrastructure, because in this presentation I'm actually just not going to look at infrastructure as one asset class. I'm going to look at it as a component, the key component asset classes, because they've actually got different characteristics. And what you can see here is a graph showing you how we define infrastructure and the size of the market. So when we look around the world and look at the companies that we could potentially invest in, we've filtered it down to about 200 companies that have a combined market cap of about $1.4 trillion. And just to put that into context, that's considerably bigger than the global REIT market or the global listed property market. So infrastructure as an asset class is actually a very big asset class. The graph on the right is showing you the breakup of that into the various components, and you can see the biggest asset class by a long way is transmission and distribution companies or utilities, and the next two are toll roads and airports. So in this presentation today, I'm just going to concentrate on those three sectors. In terms of utilities, what you'll find with a utility, and the classic example of a utility is a company that owns the poles and wires that might take the power from the power station and deliver it to the city. What you'll find in all of these sorts of utilities is they are a pure monopoly. They are the only poles and wires transmitting that electricity. And as a result, what you find all around the world is that these utilities are regulated by a government regulator. And that regulator has a fairly challenging role because what they've got to do is make sure that the utility keeps reinvesting into the business. But they're also got to try and keep the costs or the charges that that utility levies on the people that are buying the power as low as possible. So what that utility, what that regulator is charged with is working out what sort of a return the utility should get on the assets that the utility owns. And that's a very public process. It's a process that generally involves public hearings and very much publicly released data and reports at the end of the day. So when we look around the world, it's very hard to find utilities that are materially mispriced because there are because that information is all public. It's very difficult to find stock exchanges where they haven't actually got their head around what that asset is really worth. So in our current portfolio, which is about 18 stocks, there's really only two utilities at the moment. But if you look at what happens to those utilities in times of inflation, what you find is that the regulator has to restore to the utility the level of earnings that is required to reflect the inflation. So the first thing that will happen is that the regulator will look at what impact inflation has had on nominal bond rates, and that will feed through into their cost of capital. They'll also look at what the impact of inflation is on operating costs, on their debt costs, and indeed on any new assets that are being built. And most of those utilities at any one stage would have new assets under construction. And as well as that, it looks at the effects of inflation on the assets that the company owns itself. So as a result, what you'll find is that these utilities are almost inflation-proof. There are very few utilities around the world which won't be able to recoup the entire cost or the entire revenue implications of inflation going up. Now, I add two caveats to that. The first is that in not every market does the regulator review the operations of the utility on a regular basis. In places like Australia, it can be 5 years between reviews. So if you get a very big short-term spike in inflation, that can be quite a painful experience for the utility. When you look overseas, in lots of other markets, and our investments and most of the work that we're doing is overseas for that exactly that reason, in the United States, for instance, the utilities will or can have their operations reviewed on an annual basis. So they're much more protected from any impact of inflation. The second thing I would say to you if you're investing into these areas is be very careful about how you define utility. There are very few pure utilities in Australia, probably about four listed companies in Australia that we would define as a pure utility. Most of the other companies, and AGL would be a good example, have components which are utilities, but then in addition to that, largely because they're vertically integrated, will have components that are subject to competition, as in the retailing of their power, or subject to commodity price fluctuations, as in getting the gas or buying the electricity or generating the electricity that they need in the first place. So be very careful. There will be lots of those companies that will look like utilities and will claim, and many people would classify them as infrastructure, but they fail our test because a large part of their business is not a monopoly, is not regulated, and doesn't have the sort of protection we would seek to get from not only inflation but a whole bunch of other things that you were looking to get when we're investing into infrastructure. In terms of toll roads, toll roads are very different in terms of your typical toll road doesn't have a regulator looking at it and regulating its earnings. The regulatory process is all done at the time the concession is awarded. So the typical model that you will see around the world is that the government awards a concession agreement, a concession contract. It's simply a contract between the government and the owner. And that contract entitles the concession company to collect tolls for a defined number of years. It generally defines how those tolls will increase over the terms of the concession, and it requires the concession company to run the toll road and to hand it back to the government at the end of the concession period. So what that is doing, the regulation process there is regulating pricing, not earnings. And therefore, what you find is that there is more scope for the concession company, for the infrastructure company, to earn significantly greater than the market might be thinking it from time to time. So here is a is an asset class where you do get material mispricings, and certainly in our portfolio of stocks at the moment, the majority of them are toll roads for that reason. Toll roads, and in particular urban toll roads, have very high EBITDA margins, and that's quite important, as Matt has said, and we'll come back to that. CapEx is generally very small, certainly less than 5% in most cases. And the final thing that I would say, again, just in terms of a warning, we're absolutely paranoid about where we will invest, because one of the biggest risks in investing in infrastructure is what we call sovereign risk, which is the risk that the government won't honour the terms of the contract. And we see time and time again governments in non-OECD countries, and in recent times we've seen examples in China, in Thailand and in Malaysia, where the government has refused to allow toll increases when contractually they were entitled to do so. So be very careful about investing in companies that have any significant exposure to non-OECD countries. I just thought I'd show you some of the sort of typical basis on which tolls go up around the world. And these are sort of, all of these companies here would be ones that we've invested in. So the 407 in Toronto, which is in effect the biggest asset that we own within our portfolio. The basis of the tolls there, it's actually one of only three toll roads in the world where the government that signed the contract was generous enough to say, you can put the tolls up by as much as you like. And in fact, you can put it up as often as you like in that case. So that's a pretty unusual occurrence. There is another one down here, the M6 toll. Incidentally, both of those assets, one of the major shareholders in it is Macquarie Infrastructure Group. Very typically what you'll find in Europe is that, and here's an example of France, Italy and Portugal, the concession agreement will say you can put your tolls up as a percentage of CPI. So in the case of APRR, which is a French company, by 85% of CPI. The more typical thing that you will see generally around the world is an example here, which is the Cross Harbour Tunnel in Hong Kong, where there is just a direct linkage with CPI. And a lot of the toll roads that we've seen in most other countries outside Europe, that would be the case. I've shown here a couple of other interesting ones where the government has agreed to toll increases that actually give the owners some upside. So Matt mentioned before the Eastern Distributor. The tolls on that road actually go up by the greater of 1% per quarter or 4.1% per annum. Or a basket of two-thirds average weekly earning and one-third inflation. So if you get a big increase in wages, you pick up the benefit of that. You get a big increase in inflation, you pick up the benefit of that. If not, you're getting 4.1% per annum, which historically is certainly well above the inflation rate here. So that's not a bad deal. I have to say I was involved in that, so I take a little bit of ownership of it. The recent ones have been done overseas. The Chicago Skyway was a very interesting one. Again, that was Macquarie Infrastructure Group and Cintra, which Cintra is a Spanish toll road company, which is our biggest investment. That was a 75-year concession, and they were able to negotiate a deal there where they got the greater of 2% nominal GDP per capita or inflation. So again, there, what they've been able to do is protect themselves from inflation, get the benefit of global or economic growth within America, and if both of those are benign, then you're at least getting 2%. And when you compound that out over 75 years, that's an awful lot of increases. So, okay, you can put the tolls up, but what happens when you put the tolls up in terms of what happens to the usage of the road? And I've given you here an example of the Eastern Distributor in Sydney. I assume most people in this room have used the Eastern Distributor on a couple of occasions. So what this graph is showing you here is the traffic in the first year. So this is March, June, September quarter. So that was when it opened back in 2000. And so you can see that the traffic building up fairly nicely as each year goes by. You can see the toll increases coming through. And the key thing that you can see there is that when they put the tolls up, it actually doesn't have any impact on traffic numbers. So to give you the most recent example, they put the tolls up on the 1st of April from $4.50 to $5, which is about an 11% increase, and the traffic in the June quarter was up about 2.5%. Now, I put it to you that there's actually not a lot of consumer products out there where you can put the price up and demand goes up, or usage goes up, or sales go up. But this is an example of it, and in fact, it's a very common example of it. We see lots and lots of toll roads where you see this perfect inelasticity. And we will see more of them over time. And the simple reason is, if you think about it, a toll road is only as good as the alternative is bad. And the worse the alternative gets, the better the toll road becomes. So over time, all the alternatives are going to get worse. That's inevitable. And what that means is, if there is any elasticity, if traffic does leave the road because of a toll increase, it'll come back. And over time, it'll come back more quickly, and over time, it'll trend down towards zero. There are fascinating, I love toll roads, serious character flaw, I'm sure, but it really is fascinating if you think about it. This is a contract that you have with the government, and that contract says every time you put your tolls up, you automatically make more money. You know, we haven't seen a toll road anywhere in the world, government or privately owned, that when they put the tolls up, they didn't make more money. And it costs you nothing to put the tolls up. So first thing happens, you make more money. The second thing is, if you lose any traffic, it goes back to competing roads, and the performance of all your competitors deteriorates, which means that you've got less traffic on your road, therefore the performance of your particular product increases. There's no other, we haven't been able to find any other commodity, any other consumer service or product anywhere in the world that behaves like that. It's just a fundamentally attractive thing. And just to give you a further example of that, this is the 407 toll road in Toronto. As I said, one of our bigger asset exposures. And what I've done here is just graphed what happens in terms of the toll increase and the traffic increase since this road was privatised. So the blue line shows you what the toll increase is. So in this year, they put the tolls up by 5%. And the traffic went up by about 11% on top of that. So you had about a 17% increase in revenue. Okay? No cost increase. Costs don't change when that happens. Just 17% in revenue drops straight to the bottom line. So you can see every year here, they got a bit greedy that year. They put the tolls up by 13%, but they still got traffic growth. And so what you're seeing, even in the most recent period, with petrol prices being what they are, and bear in mind petrol prices in Canada have gone up by a lot more than they have here, they've still been able to put their tolls up by an average about 9.4%, and they're still getting 2 to 3% traffic growth. And I suspect, if anything, our estimate there is going to be conservative because it's starting to bounce back quite nicely. And just again to give you an indication of why that would be case, and this is a bit of a complicated graph, but it's important to understand in terms of how toll roads behave. What this is a graph of is the 401, which is your major alternative route to the 407. The 401 is a 16-lane wide road, runs basically through the middle of Toronto. And what this is a graph of is the 24-hour traffic pattern. So this is midnight through to midnight. And this, the yellow line here is what the traffic looked like in 1970. So you had your morning peak, classically traffic dropped off in the middle of the day, then you had your afternoon peak. By 1980, what you saw is the peak had increased, as well as the middle of the day. The traffic was building up earlier, and of course it was staying heavier later. By 2005, what you've got is a situation is that this road is completely full by 6 o'clock in the morning, and it stays there till about 9 o'clock at night every day of the week. So the alternative is completely... is completely choked and has no capacity for further growth. So every single additional car that's going to go down that corridor from this point on is going to go onto the 407. It may not go there directly, it may push one of the other cars across, but effectively this road is just about at absolute capacity. So again, what we're looking for, we're investing in these toll roads, are toll roads where the alternative route is very heavily congested and where there's very little opportunity for it to improve in terms of capacity. So that's how they perform in terms of revenue. What is then the case in terms of costs? And as Matt talked about, we've got EBITDA margins. So what we're showing here is your typical EBITDA margin, again, across the assets that I showed you before. The European toll roads, because they're very long distance roads, there's a lot more maintenance and so on, tend to have the lowest EBITDA margin. So Atlantia, which is the Italian toll road network, a bit over 60%. But by the time you get to some of the smaller toll roads, you're getting well over 80%, getting up towards 90%. So 10 to 15% of your revenue is needed to operate the road. The rest of it's available for either debt or equity. So again, the cost issues are not... inflationary impact on costs is almost irrelevant. And just to illustrate that again, using the 407, there's your revenue line increasing. There's your costs that have basically been almost stationary now for the last 8 years. It'll start to kick up from there, but it won't do very much, to be honest. So what you've had is 18% compound growth in free cash flow on that road for the last 9 or 10 years. It's not going to continue at 18%, but it's certainly going to be high single to low double-digit numbers for a considerable period of time. And there's another 90 years to go on that concession. That is before interest, and I'll come to that for sure. Let me just turn to airports now. Airports generally fall into two categories, what's known as single-till or dual-till. A single-till airport is typical. BAA in London is an example of that, where effectively all of the revenue from all of the sources goes through to the concession owner, and there is effectively either a regulator looking at what those returns are or the threat that the regulator will come in if you try to charge too much. It's, in our mind, a fairly unattractive model, and it doesn't you don't see it too much around the world. The much more common model is what they call a dual-till model, and that is where you split the operations of the airport up into the land side, the landing charges and the baggage handling on the one side, and the air side and the land side, which is your retail and your parking and your property development. That's much more typical Sydney Airport, Melbourne, and in fact all the Australian airports, Auckland, Fraport, Frankfurt, Copenhagen and Zurich. And that is pretty typical. So what you've got is a regulated utility, which will give you automatic inflation protection on one side, and effectively a large urban shopping centre on the other side with a very significantly highly captured audience. So the regulated part of it is well protected from inflation. The car parking component, well, frankly, on an airport like Sydney, you can almost charge what you like, and you've all experienced that, I'm sure. So the ability to put up your car parking charges without much impact on inflation, I think, is very demonstrable. In terms of the retailing business, it's a typical shopping centre arrangement where you're taking a guaranteed rent, which has an inflation element to it, plus you are getting a percentage of profits. So if retail sales go up with inflation, as you would imagine they would, then you're going to get a benefit out of that. I've mentioned a couple of warnings on each of these asset classes on the way through in terms of what to be careful about. In terms of airports, the biggest thing that we would caution people about is that you want to be investing in airports where the majority of the business is origin and destination. That is, people who... you want an airport where there is a population that need to go there and a population that are going away from there. There are a number of airports around the world that survive because they're hub airports. They're used as a major hub by airlines, bringing people in and then flying them out on another airline. Those hubs can change. That airline can go broke, and you can have a very substantial change in the earnings of that business. So, again, what we tend to concentrate our investments on are airports where the origin and destination component of the business is very high. How resilient are airports? Well, in our view... airports are probably at the highest end of the risk spectrum within the infrastructure sector. They have the highest element of discretionary spending and therefore the highest risk. And yet if we look historically, they've actually been very resilient. So what I've graphed here is in the blue line, arrivals and departures, or factually just arrivals in New Zealand through Auckland Airport going back to 1980, showing you that it's been growing at about 2.5 times GDP, and that would be a fairly typical growth pattern that we'd see all around the world. You do see periods where traffic goes flat, but what you do find is that when it does, it tends to come back to the longer-term trend line. We think we may have actually just been through a period where that's fundamentally changing. One of the reasons why you see that pattern is that airfares in real terms have been coming down around the world for about the last 30 years, in fact longer. We now think that that's probably hit the bottom and we're going to see real increases in airfares going forward. So it won't be quite so resilient. So things are going to change. This won't be a particularly nice place to be for the next couple of years, but the fundamentals of this asset class are still very strong. In terms of EBITDA margins, you get much greater variation in EBITDA margins across here. A lot of people might be critical of Macquarie Bank and how they run things, but here's Sydney Airport with an 80% EBITDA margin. Here's a whole bunch of airports overseas that are run by companies directly themselves, and you can see that there's a massive difference in the efficiency of those airports. Now, some of that's to do with the fact that the baggage handling is actually done by the airport itself rather than outsourced. But a lot of it is to do with the fact that the Macquarie people, I have to say, have been very good at maximising the worth that they got out of buying Sydney Airport. Now, let's talk about debt and gearing. If you've got a lot of debt in an asset and you don't have it hedged and inflation goes up, then your interest rates go up, you're in trouble. There's no doubt about that. If you look around the world at the companies that have been in trouble in the last 6 to 12 months to 2 years, that is classically those sorts of companies. Typically, when you look around the world in infrastructure companies and infrastructure assets, the lending that goes into individual assets is generally non-recourse project finance. So if I wanted to develop, if Cintra wants to develop a toll road in the US, they won't borrow the money at the company level, at the corporate level. They will go out and borrow the money directly from the banks, and it will go in at the asset level, and that will be non-recourse back to the company concerned. So the only comfort that the lenders get is the cash flows coming out of that asset. They're rare for the parent company to actually guarantee those revenues. As a result of that, the lenders will almost always say, we'll lend you this certain amount of money, but we want ourselves to be protected from a spike in inflation. So again, it's fairly typical when you look around the world to see that the lenders require that the next three or five years of interest payments are fully hedged out to fixed interest rate debt. So just showing you here, typically across our portfolio, the level of gearing, and we've broken it down by the assets we've invested in there, the level of gearing, so you can see ports, for instance, which that number's just coincidental. We've just happened to be invested in two ports with very little debt at the moment. But typically what you would find for most infrastructure assets is that you've got about 50-50 gearing, and we're very comfortable with that is the case. And what you can see on the right-hand side in terms of our portfolio is that the vast majority of that debt is hedged out for the next 2 or 3 years. So what you're then seeing is, when we look at these infrastructure assets in summary, almost all of them have some way of recouping inflation into revenues. They've got very high EBITDA margins, relatively low fixed, low variable costs, and in most cases they've got very high levels of interest rate hedging. So they may not be the perfect asset class, and certainly not every company and not every part of the infrastructure sector is the perfect asset class when it comes to an inflation spike, but we think they're very, very good areas, places to be if you do get an increase in inflation. Are you summarising or me? I'll keep going. I think I have, actually. Yes, I have. Okay. Do we take questions at this stage?
I'll go to the next slide.
That is the next slide.
Okay, so thanks very much, Dennis. Please put your hands together for Dennis. Just before we go to Q&A, I just wanted to sort of touch on some things briefly that are in some ways have already been mentioned by Dennis. Firstly, the global infrastructure universe is pretty darn big. It was about 50% of the US equity universe back in the early 1900s, and it's come to the fore once again. And you can see that based on the benchmarks, the two UBS benchmarks, the global infrastructure universe is roughly triple that of REITs, so it's certainly something worth considering in your portfolios. Secondly, many institutional investors around the world are certainly investing into this asset class, typically as part of their inflation-linked asset pool. So there's certainly anecdotal evidence that people are using these assets as part of their defences against inflation. The key question we get a lot from planners say, look, I love infrastructure, I love the asset class, where can I put it? I'm thinking of replacing property with it. We don't have anything against property, but infrastructure and property are two very, very different asset classes. And the key reasons for this are that, firstly, the inflation linkages that sit within infrastructure don't necessarily hold true of property. Certainly, ING just did a presentation that made some arguments for inflation protection, but at the end of the day, property is a competitive arena. Office buildings compete with office buildings next door to them. So they do tend to be more subject to inflation. Additionally, they're more subject to the economic conditions at the time. That can be a great thing or can be a bad thing. When the economy is booming, you're an office manager, you can really ramp up your rent, so you benefit from huge pickups in economic activity, and you also suffer from downturns in economic activity. In summary, simply what we're saying is that property is a high risk, high return asset class and infrastructure, without question. So you need to consider that within your portfolio, and we do argue that infrastructure is a separate asset class altogether from property. With that, I think we're going to Q&A.
Okay, to start the Q&A session, I'd like to introduce Lucas de Porbe from Lonsec in Melbourne, and then we'll open it up to the room.
Just a quick question, I suppose. Over the course of the last 12 months, you know, mentioned the issues surrounding some companies becoming under greater pressure because of gearing. One of the questions, that I suppose a lot of people would have, you've seen sectors such as property and also infrastructure being sold off quite heavily, just essentially because there's gearing, it has high level underlying gearing. What's your view on the likely the volatility going forward of the sector, given that you are seeing still in the market, you are seeing listed assets being sold off because of that sort of sentiment, negative sentiment in the market? And I suppose secondly, in terms of your portfolio, have you had to go through the underlying assets you've had, and has there been any sort of cause of concern with some of the assets in terms of the debt structures in place?
Just answering the second question first. Magellan is owned by, two of the guys that set up Magellan, Chris Mackay, who was previously chairman and managing director of UBS, and Hamish Douglas, who was head of investment banking at Deutsche Bank. Both guys who had enormous experience in investment banking and credit markets generally. And I can't remember which of them was, pulled us aside in about March or April last year and said, things are going to get a bit rough around here in terms of credit markets. We suggest that every asset you invest in, you have a very good look at how the debt is structured, and in particular, what levels of debt are going to need to be rolled over in the next 18 months to 2 years. Now, we generally do that anyway, but we certainly paid more attention to it. And so I'd have to say, in answer to your second question, none of the assets that we've invested in have had any problems with that. In terms of your first question, the first part of it, the answer would be the Australian market has significantly underperformed the global market over the last 12 months. We've seen a much bigger sell-off in Aussie infrastructure stocks than we have in the overseas ones. In my mind, that's for three reasons. The first is that the Macquarie Bank, Babcock and Brown type model of a separate manager from the investment trust is almost unique to Australia. In fact, the only other places that you will see similar structures are where Babcock's or Macquarie have set it up in other countries. So when we look at the companies that we've invested in overseas, they're all pure companies, and none of them have had the sort of sentiment problems that we've seen associated with those sorts of vehicles in Australia. The second thing is that, and it's tied to the first, the Australian companies do tend to have more gearing than the overseas companies. So again, there's probably, if people are concerned about debt and levels of gearing generally, then there's, I guess, been more logical reason for why they should be sold off here. Having said that, if we look back at our portfolio 12 months ago, there was possibly one or two Australian stocks in there. Now there's four or five. And that's simply because the Aussie stocks have been sold down to quite silly levels in our mind and represent some absolutely compelling value. And in a few cases, our value would be pretty close to double the share price, and in some cases even a bit more than that. Now, they're not all great buys, and you've got to be very careful. We, for instance, have never even bothered to analyse any of the Babcock and Brown stocks. And that's simply because the level of disclosure they gave us and the level of transparency in their documents was so bad that we wouldn't even bother wasting our time trying to work out what they were worth. On the other hand, I have to say that Macquarie do a lot of things poorly, but one of the things they do very well is the level of detail they're prepared to give the market on what their vehicles have invested in and how they're structured. So Macquarie Infrastructure Group, for instance, gives you a financial model on every one of the assets that they've invested in. I don't use that model. I build my own models. But it's there. It has every level of debt within each of their assets. It tells you when what the interest rates are, tells you what the covenants are, tells you when it's got to be refinanced. If you're investing in those vehicles, you can invest with your eyes wide open. So the market has massively overreacted to gearing levels. Gearing is not as bad as evil as people are making out, and there's some fantastic buying opportunities, both here and overseas at the moment. The other part of the answer I would give you is that there seems to be this focus that companies aren't going to be able to renew their debt, or if they do, that it's going to be much more expensive than it's been in the past. I can tell you that overseas companies are having absolutely no problem, overseas infrastructure companies are having absolutely no problem raising new debt or renewing debt that exists. Now, the margins have gone out, but the base rates have gone down. So we're seeing companies renewing debt now before they even need to, because they can get that debt cheaper in total interest rate terms than they could have even 2 years ago. The banks do love these assets in tough times, and the credit markets are very much wide open for good infrastructure stocks.
Sorry, we need to use this. This session's being taped.
Dennis, I was wondering if you could comment on Connect East, because it seemed to be a shining star in the infrastructure toll roads, and then it opens up and the share price plummets. So could you give us a comment on that, and maybe the cycle that these newly opened toll roads, you know, what sort of monetary cycle they go through?
I've got this. Can you hear me okay if I just use
that? That should be working.
I talked about before how attractive a toll road is as a consumer product when you put the tolls up. The opposite to that is that the dynamic of a new toll road coming onto the market, it is about as bad as you can imagine for any new product you're putting onto the market. And the reason for that is pretty simple. You open Connect East, it gets a bunch of traffic coming across to it. Where does that traffic come from? Well, it comes from all the roads that are running parallel. So what happens to the cars that are using those roads? Well, all of a sudden, it's fantastic. So you're putting a product onto the market, and all of a sudden, every one of the competing products improves in performance. That's just a lousy dynamic. The other thing that you find is that when you look at the development of traffic from when a toll road first opened over the next 2 years, you get massively varying rates of growth. In some cases, I can give you instances where the traffic growth from day one to the end of the second year was, in one case that I can think of, less than 40%. And in other cases, it's 200%. So the market's sitting back with Connect East, where they have come up with numbers which are way below forecasts for the first full year, and trying to work out what the angle of that first week's traffic is for the next 2 years. And to be honest,
What you're trying to do is predict irrational behaviour. The reason it ramps up so much in that first 2 years is because people are saying, I don't care how good it is, I don't want to pay the toll. But inevitably, you wear them down. Inevitably, they get to the point of saying, oh, bugger it, I'll pay the toll. And it just is a period of time before that happens. And, I don't like those figures very much. My forecasts were about 40% below the prospectus forecasts in the opening. It's opened about 50% below, so it's below mine. But my numbers by the end of year three are about where the prospectus numbers were, and my numbers by the year 30 are above where they're forecasting, and I haven't changed my numbers at this stage.
Dennis, many clients understand the reason and the need to invest in hard assets, and particularly the need to put that in their portfolios. One of the concerns they have, however, is the understanding of investing into a fund that has a level of gearing that then invests in listed assets that also have gearing.
Yep.
And when asset prices change, the actual net equity can change quite dramatically.
Absolutely.
Help us understand that real position in the levels that, in many ways, that they're actually gearing into another geared product.
Yeah. No, it's a good question, and certainly... my first piece of advice was that you should probably tend to avoid trusts or entities where there is gearing at both levels, because that makes absolutely no sense, really. You should have the gearing at the asset level for tax reasons, for no other purpose. And if you put additional gearing at the top, you're just adding risk. I mean, I keep talking about Macquarie, but unfortunately they are the people that have set the rules here in many cases. There was this attitude within Macquarie that you could add gearing without adding risk, and it's just absolute nonsense. Your house is worth exactly the same no matter how much you've borrowed against it, and the way we value things is we value their house and take the gearing off. You can increase your equity internal rate of return by adding gearing, but it increases your risk, and one offsets the other completely in our mind. So most of the funds that you look at these days won't have gearing at the holding company level, at the trust company level. So Macquarie Infrastructure Group and MAP do not have gearing at the trust level. Macquarie Communications does. So you have to distinguish it on that basis. Again, most of the companies that we invest in overseas, there won't be much, if any, debt at the holding company level. It'll all be down at the asset level.
Thanks, Dennis. I just had a question around, do you analyse sensitivity to oil prices, for example? At what point would you say that if oil reaches a certain level that we're going to get a reduced level of activity on the toll roads? Just mindful that some of those, that data early was when oil was substantially cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's something that occupies our mind a lot. And we've reviewed as much academic studies as we can on this. And there is sufficient evidence to suggest that there is at least short-term elasticity of about 0.2 on petrol price increases. So if you get petrol going up by 100%, you'll get a 20% drop in traffic. The evidence historically has been that that's pretty temporary, and that particularly on work days that trips go back to their natural level. I think it's easy to underestimate just how pervasive motor cars are in today's society. If I gave you the example of the 407 in Toronto, on a work day, 98% of all trips made in Toronto are by motor car, only 2% by public transport. And there's a pretty good reason for that. In the middle of winter when it's minus 25 degrees, you don't want to be standing outside waiting for a bus for too long because you'll perish. So in winter, everyone drives a car, even if it's 200 yards down to the local shop. Everyone has two-car garages, and the whole of that society is based on that. And frankly, it's hard for us to see that's going to change very much. Typically in Australian cities, your level is about 90%. So in Sydney and Melbourne, about 90% of all trips made by anyone on any one day are by car. You might be interested to know the average income of people who catch public transport in Sydney is considerably higher than the average income of people who drive. Because why is that? All the jobs for high paid people are on the train lines because they were built 50 years ago and all the employment is along those lines. But the average person who uses a toll road in Sydney is not a white collar worker, they're a blue collar worker. And they're driving a car because it is the only feasible means of getting to where they're going. So we do think about it a lot. We think the impact will be much greater in the airline industry and the airport business generally than it will be in toll roads. Because that will feed through into the pricing of tickets and there's a discretionary element to that. What we have done in terms of our own portfolio is made sure that we have biased the toll road exposures to urban toll roads rather than interurban toll roads. And the reason for that, again, is pretty simple. If you're making short trips, the impact of a petrol price increase is not that important. If you're doing 100 kilometres, well, maybe you will catch the train because if you... Europe as an example, because that is a more viable alternative. One of the interesting things, incidentally, the higher the petrol price, the lower the cost of the toll in relative terms, because you don't want to be sitting on the alternative route burning up fuel, so that the toll road actually becomes more attractive. So if you look at, the impact of the petrol price spike that we had here 2 years ago when petrol started to go up by a lot initially, what you were seeing is 7 or 8% drops in traffic on the free roads and 2 or 3% increases in traffic on the toll roads. So you actually saw a shift in market share from the free roads to the toll roads because they were free flowing.
I think we've just got time for one more. Thanks, Dennis. Just two things I was wondering if you could comment on. One is the restructuring model we're seeing in infrastructure now, obviously a shift away from paying distributions from debt to a model where they're saying we're going to start paying distributions from cash flow.
Yep.
And given investors originally looked at infrastructure as a high-yield instrument, with those yields obviously having to come down given a move to cash flow, if you could comment on that. And secondly, you talked about projected sort of traffic forecasts and things like that. I think without mentioning names, everyone knows the last two toll roads that went bankrupt in Sydney on the back of overzealous traffic forecasts.
Yep.
And also if you could talk a little bit about, I don't know if you heard the IPO for Bruce Connections, I think last trade at 25 cents. I mean, it got priced in a tough environment and yet the thing got thrown to the ground. So just those three.
In terms of dividends, the dividend paid by, the dividend yield of any asset is completely unrelated to how much the asset is worth because it very much depends on what stage in the asset it is. The dividend yield on the 407 in Toronto, you know, if I could invest my entire family fortune, what little amount there is there, in one asset, that would be it. I'd be very happy to sell my house and in every single dollar invested into that asset, and yet the yield's about 0.5% at the moment. Yield is unimportant when it comes to determining value because it depends at what stage of the maturity of the asset, how long it's got to go before you have to hand it back to the government, a whole raft of things like that. In terms of paying dividends out of debt, that was always a nonsense. It will continue to be a nonsense, and I was very happy to see Transurban bite the bullet and come out with a sensible policy, and I just hope all the others do that. This should be a low-risk, low-return asset class. And adding gearing to artificially grow dividends is just a nonsense. Let's go back to some basic fundamentals, and that's what they've done there. The share price is now back above where it was when they made that decision, even though everyone threw their hands up and said it's the end of the world. I suspect more and more companies will go that way as well. Sorry, there was another element. Brisbane Connections. I haven't actually valued that asset because I believe that the River City asset that connects into it, my traffic forecast, and I did model that separately, my traffic forecasts on that were way below what were done in the IPO. And the other one is interconnected with it and based on it, and therefore there was not much point in wasting my time on it. One of the biggest problems you have, and I've seen it from a construction company and I've seen it from working with an investment bank, is that the process of developing, say, traffic forecasts for a greenfield toll road is controlled by either the construction company or the investment bank. And I can tell you from experience, it's not hard to get bigger numbers than they should. You know, it's in fact, demonstrably, there's 25% optimism bias in traffic forecasts produced in those circumstances. So our natural inclination is, you know, we'll take the report, take 25% off, and then we'll start looking at it after that. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap it up there, Dennis. And I'm just going to pass over to Lucas to comment on portfolio construction issues quickly.
Yeah, just very briefly, I suppose one of the issues, we have seen a lot of funds come onto the market in this sector, and the big dilemma is where do they fit within a portfolio? Lonsec, as a house, has introduced infrastructure into some of the asset allocation risk profiles, namely in the growth and the high growth risk profiles. Now, we do view it as a growth asset, obviously. It does offer diversification benefits through low correlation with other assets. However, it should be kept in mind that infrastructure is a long-term investment, and it can be volatile at certain points of the market, as we have seen over the recent periods. And like some of the points raised in the presentation, a lot of these infrastructure assets, it takes time for them to come to fruition and to generate those returns. That's really what I want to say is number one, it's in the growth part. It should be in the growth part of the portfolio, Lonsec believes. It will be volatile at certain periods of time, and it is a long-term investment. So if you're going into this asset class thinking that you're going to make, a quick buck out of it, it's probably not the right asset class to sort of invest in. So I'll sort of probably leave it at that and pass it on to Matt.
Thanks, Lucas. Just the quick compulsory 30-second product flog. So Dennis is going to be around at our stand during lunchtime, so please feel free to come and speak to myself, Frank Casarotti, who's in the room, or Dennis Eager about Magellan's infrastructure capabilities. For those of you who don't know who Magellan is, Magellan's a Sydney-based boutique global equity and global infrastructure equity specialist, and we set up this fund back in July 2007. It's fully hedged back to Aussie dollars. The MER's there. We have a very, very tight definition of infrastructure, so no surprises for investors. That is, it must exhibit monopoly or monopoly-style characteristics, and the asset must be required for the efficient function of the community. Doesn't fit both those, doesn't get into the portfolio, pretty simple stuff. And we also have a dual performance benchmark, which is quite unique. We get a percentage of excess return, so we get 10.1% of excess return over the market benchmark being UBS. But very importantly, we've got to beat the Australian 10-year government bond yield, so we don't charge your investors if your investors are going backwards. That's about it. I now need to take if you could grab your gizmos out, whack the card into said gizmo, and press number 4. Yeah. We're good to go at the back there?